Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an initiative by the Justice Department to go after banks who do business with payday lenders and fly-by-night online merchants that has already come under attack by Congressman Darrell Issa, who is coming to the defense of predatory lenders who, in the first case brought by the DOJ, illegally withdrew $2.4 billion from the checking accounts of bank customers across the country. Benjamin Holman, the senior financial writer for the Huffington Post, joins us to discuss how, without the help of big banks, payday lenders who have migrated from storefronts to the internet would not be able to operate outside of the U.S. and state banking regulations. Then we'll examine the spread of the publicly funded teaching of creationism and climate change denial in schools across America. Zach Coplin, an anti-creationist activist and columnist for The Guardian, joins us to discuss his new report at Slate, Texas Public Schools Are Teaching Creationism, and the for-profit charter schools that teach students Filipinos are pagans, feminists turn to the state as a surrogate husband, and that FDR's New Deal did not help the economy but instead ushered in a new era of dependency on the federal government. Then finally, we will speak with George Lakoff, a distinguished professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He has an article at the Huffington Post, State of the Union 2014, The Cognitive Power of the President, that argues Obama has the power in his upcoming State of the Union speech to put important ideas in people's minds that could shape the public discourse on global warming, on chemicals polluting drinking water, on the use of immoral fuels like coal, oil, nuclear, and natural gas, as well as the ability to explode the worshipful Republican myth of job creators by redefining workers as profit creators. And joining us now is Ben Holman, who is a senior financial writer at the Huffington Post based in New York. Previously, he was a business and finance reporter at the investigative nonprofit, the Center for Public Integrity, and was also a legal affairs reporter for The American Lawyer. His story about the crash of Lehman Brothers was anthologized in the Best American Legal Writing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Holman.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
And the Justice Department have just launched this new initiative, Operation Choke Point. And I take it that they consider the banks that allow payday lenders and sort of fly-by-night internet merchants access to bank to be able to drain money from unsuspecting customers' banking accounts. Let me ask you, where is the choke point in Operation Choke Point?
Well, I think you're about to get there. I mean, I think it's the banks themselves. I mean, these banks are essentially selling access to the financial system to these payday lenders, especially the internet payday lenders that have cropped up and are sort of taking over the industry.
And exactly how do they do it? I mean, I take it that the banks provide services to third-party payment processors and financial middlemen. Is that how it works?
Well, that's right. And these financial middlemen are then, the hosts for, or have as clients, rather, I guess, basically all of the internet payday providers. So it allows them direct access, essentially, to customer accounts, customer checking accounts, customer savings accounts. And these are customers who are often in states that have banned payday lending, or at least have set very strict limits on the types of interest rates that can be charged on payday loans.
So, from the customer's point of view, I mean, they must have had some relationship to the purchase. So what is the rubric under which they can extract their funds out of their checking accounts?
Well, the bargain essentially is this, someone goes online, and I mean, it used to be that you would go to your storefront lender, and that still happens in some places, but states have been cracking down, and increasing these lenders have been going online. So, you go online, you link up with a payday company, and then you agree to borrow, say, a couple $100 in exchange for paying it back at a set time, a couple weeks in the future, maybe. With whatever interest fees tacked on. Just to be clear, these interest fees, can go 300%, 500%, 1,000%. They're extremely high in some instances. And the deal that the customer thinks that they're getting is that, that they turn over their account information to the payday lender, and it makes everything easier. The payday lender deposits the money directly in their account, and then a few weeks later, withdraws it back again. But so what these, this, you know, we have one lawsuit that we've seen so far against a bank in North Carolina called Four Oaks Bank. And what it alleges is that this bank, you know, that the lenders that were using this bank would, you know, embed confusing language in the small type that, you know, stated that the bank would have the right to withdraw smaller amounts of money, thereby triggering this sort of rolling set of fees until the consumer's account was essentially dry.
And this one bank that they're going after, the Four Oaks Bank in North Carolina, the prosecutors say that the bank enabled these companies to illegally withdraw more than $2.4 billion. I mean, that's not small change.
That's just one bank. You know, they collected, I think, close to $1 million in fees for that service that they were selling. And, this is one bank, and you know, the Justice Department supposedly has its eyes on 40 or 50 at least other financial institutions. So, you know, we're talking about a lot of money. I mean, it's still surprising to me how many people, avail themselves of this service, these payday services. It's, you know, millions of people each month take out a payday loan.
Well, I remember that a law was passed some time back because payday lenders were corralling or setting up shop around military bases, like in North Carolina and the big military bases, and they were getting service people hooked on payday loans, and you know, needless to say, you know, soldiers and sailors and Marines don't get paid a lot of money. And they were basically, I believe, it might have actually been General Petraeus' wife and others who managed to push through a bill getting these payday lenders, to sort of segregating them, almost like, you know, the laws about how close you can come to an abortion clinic, that kind of a law.
That's right. Holly Petraeus pushed for that. I mean, and that is the, I mean, so this is one of the reasons why payday lending is still such a pernicious problem, is that there is that law. You're not, I believe the interest rate that you're allowed to charge a service member can't exceed 36%. I might be a little bit off on that, but it's relatively low compared to the interest rates that, civilians can be charged. But that's the only federal limit on how much a lender can charge someone. So aside from that, it's up to the states to decide how much these guys can charge.
So you're better off with the mafia, right? By long shot, if you get up to 500%, that's worse than Vigorish, isn't it?
Well, that's what and that's the complaint. Obviously, consumer advocates have. I mean, I almost hesitate to do so, but you know, the argument that these lenders make is that they are a alternative to going to, you know, a loan shark, that, you know, they're not going to break your kneecaps if you don't pay. But, I think from the perspective of someone who, you know, took out $200 and, you know, ended up paying $700, $800, $900 in fees, it's not much of a better deal.
Again, I'm speaking with Ben Holman, who's a senior financial writer at the Huffington Post based in New York. Previously, he was a business and finance reporter at the investigative nonprofit, the Center for Public Integrity, and was also a legal affairs reporter for The American Lawyer. His story about the crash of Lehman Brothers was anthologized in The Best American Legal Writing. So this Justice Department effort, and as you well know, Ben, the Justice Department has not exactly been zealous in going after Wall Street. Nobody's really of any high profile has been held to account for the 2008 crash, and there's been quite a lot of criticism of Lenny Brewer, who went through the revolving ball back to Wall Street. But now that the Justice Department appears to at least be taking on payday lenders and the banks that facilitate their activities, who should step up but Daryl Issa? And of course, Daryl Issa is I guess he never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity to get into the limelight in terms of congressional grandstanding. But what do we know so far about his efforts to intervene on behalf of these payday lenders?
Well, you know, he sent a letter, you know, basically questioning the motives of the Justice Department. He's been consistently advocated for corporate interests, I think, since he took over the chairmanship of the Oversight Committee. So, I mean, I guess this is keeping in character with sort of his, you know, his stated mission, which is to sort of stop overzealous federal prosecutors from, you know, issuing sort of blanket subpoenas. But you know, even by that measure, it's hard to find, even in Washington, someone to stick up for the payday loan industry. But I guess ISA has decided to take that on for himself.
Well, I mean, aren't they capitalist bottom feeders? I mean, is there any? The Chamber of Commerce, people like that, surely would hold their noses, wouldn't they? Keep their distance.
Yeah, you're not going to get an argument. I'm definitely not going to argue for the value they provide to society. I mean, you know, again, you know, I've talked to these people, you know, over the years, and they always sort of lay out this setting whereby, there is a problem that exists, right? I mean, there are underbanked people. There are people who can't get credit cards, and those people have, you know, financial emergencies just like the rest of us. And so the scenario they always sort of roll out is, you know, of this single mom who, you know, her mom, you know, maybe her car broke down and she has, you know, she relies on it to get to work. And, you know, but for a payday lender, she wouldn't have been able to get the $300 to get the new transmission and she would have lost her job, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, it's certainly possible that in some isolated incidents, there are, you know, people who desperately need this money. They pay, you know, they pay a high fee, but at least they don't lose their job. But I really think that's the exception. I mean, every study that's looked at how this industry operates finds that people become essentially addicted to these products, that, you know, they borrow a little bit this month and then have to borrow a little bit more the next month to pay off that loan. They'll sometimes go from, you know, lender to lender to lender in order to keep paying off the other one. And it's just a rolling cycle. This lawsuit, this federal lawsuit describes a vortex of debt. And I think that's a pretty good, you know, description of what happens for a lot of people who get sort of sucked into these financial products, which, you know, I think are pretty hard to defend.
Well, Ben Holman, there obviously is a lobby for the payday lenders, is there not? I mean, they fought Holly Petraeus and they're alive and well, aren't they?
Oh, sure. They have lobbyists. I mean, and they've always been, I mean, you know, I think that this lawsuit is pretty interesting because, you know, the payday industry has been one step ahead of regulators and law enforcement officials for years. States have passed stricter laws, so they went online. You know, to get around those laws, some of these lenders will, you know, instead of calling them interest rates, they'll charge what are called application fees. So, for example, you know, in order to get under a, say, 30% threshold, they'll charge a 20% interest rate, but then a $50 application fee. So they've come up with these ways to get around federal rules for years. And this seems to be, an effort by fairly aggressive effort by the Justice Department to sort of tackle them head on. So, I think it's, a pretty exciting development, especially if, you know, you're in the camp that thinks that these are, you know, as you say, bottom feeders.
Well, but already, though, apparently the assistant U.S. attorney that's led the investigation, he has not been reauthorized. So, is there any indication to you, Ben Holman, that ISA, Darrell ISA, and others pressuring the Justice Department are having an effect, or is it? Do you think the Justice Department are going to stick by their guns?
Well, you know, look, I don't know ultimately what's going to come of this. We have one lawsuit which resulted in a relatively small settlement, it looks like, with this bank in North Carolina. But, you know, there is mounting evidence that the Justice Department is prepared to take on a lot more of these banks. And it seems like they have a pretty good case, you know, from a legal perspective. Again, since there's no federal usury law, there's nothing that, prevents at a federal level these lenders from offering these, you know, outrageous interest rate loans. But if they can show that, that banks were selling access to the financial system in order to, give these guys, a chance to cheat their customers, they might have a pretty good case. I don't think it's going to shut down the industry. And, I think history shows that these lenders have been able to essentially evade and come up with a new technique to kind of jump one step ahead of whatever the government has in store. But, you know, I think I'm generally encouraged. I don't know. Well, the ISIS letter scare them off? I think probably not. But, you know, I don't know for sure.
Well, it seems that the internet, you know, at large has become the new arena for organized crime. I've talked to cybersecurity people recently who said that, you know, it's the mob and international criminals, a lot of them out of the former Soviet Union, have discovered that you can make more money and it's much less dangerous, you know. And there's tons and tons of and we've just seen all of the wholesale thefts of credit cards from Target and other big retailers that apparently are being sold and you know sliced and diced amongst the criminal underworld. So in terms of the overall internet crime, this I suppose is the only internet crime that's enabled by banks, right? This is and that's what makes it got the attention of the Justice Department.
Well, yeah, you know, American banks, are party to or have to abide by something called the Bank Secrecy Act, which is required to know who their customers are and what they're doing to some extent. You know, that's, so this is the same issue that's coming into play in Colorado, where these, you know, marijuana merchants can't, you know, open banking accounts to store their money. That's because the, you know, banks are, afraid of running into conflict with the Bank Secrecy Act and, you know, possibly abetting some criminal activity or being accused of it. So that's what's essentially, you know, going on here is that they are potentially violating the Bank Secrecy Act by, allowing this activity to sort of run through their systems. I would guess that there probably is other criminal activity that happens as well. And certainly those cases come up from now and again, but, this is certainly an important one.
So there's a rumor, just in closing, that President Obama in his State of the Union tomorrow is going to come out with the gloves off and assert himself. So is this – could we make any assumption that the fact that the Justice Department that's been under a lot of criticism for not going after the so-called banksters is finally, ponying up and taking the gloves off?
Well, you know, I think it would be hard. As encouraged as I am by this, I think it would be a hard sell for the Justice Department to say, you know, use this as evidence that they've finally gotten tough on, you know, financial malfeasance on Wall Street. It's a lot easier to go after, this small bank in North Carolina. And I'm guessing most of these financial institutions are going to be, you know, smaller banks than it is to take on JPMorgan Chase or Bank of America or the, you know, the big banks that are, you know, widely blamed for having kind of brought on the financial crisis. So, I think that would be a stretch. he may well decide to, you know, kind of use this as evidence that they finally turned the corner and are cracking down. You know, I don't know.
Well, I suppose jailing a minnow is and not a whale is better than jailing nobody, I suppose.
So, indeed. This is a really pernicious financial product.
Sure.
You know, millions of people a year end up, you know, losing, who can't afford in the first, you know, these are people, by the way, who are on the margins in the first place, usually. They can't afford, to pay an extra $20 for something, much less an extra $50, $100, thousands of dollars. And sometimes it ends up, you know, basically ruining their lives. So, I mean, this is it shouldn't, you know, I don't want to undercut the importance of what's going on here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Ben Holman.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Ben Holman, who's a senior financial writer at the Huffington Post based in New York. Previously, he was a business and finance reporter at the investigative nonprofit, the Center for Public Integrity, and was also a legal affairs reporter for The American Lawyer. His story about the crash of Lehman Brothers was anthologized in The Best American Legal Writing. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how creationism, the teaching of creationism, has spread across America.
It's the money. truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Zach Coplin, who is an anti-creationist activist and columnist for The Guardian, who as a high school student organized 78 Nobel laureate scientists in a campaign against the Louisiana Science Education Act, a creationism law. He has a new report in Slate magazine, Texas Public Schools Are Teaching Creationism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zach Coplin.
Hey, Ian, thank you so much for having me on.
And I'm astounded at how many schools across the country or in various states have been enabled to use taxpayer money through these for-profit charter schools to teach not just creationism but global warming denial and in some cases an extraordinary version of history. I was just reading here where, for example, one of the textbooks from Responsive Education, which is one of the main Responsive Education Solutions, one of the main players in this charter system, they're even saying that John Kerry's really didn't – it's got down to sort of petty meanness that John Kerry didn't really earn his Purple Heart and Bronze Star. I mean this is extraordinary, and I guess you've been on this early, but it seems to the nose of the camel is well into the tent, isn't it?
Yeah, and so this most recent thing we've discovered is that the largest charter program in the state of Texas, Responsive Education Solutions, with 65 schools, 20 more coming in 2014, $82 million in public money, and over 17,000 students, are teaching kids things like the fossil record is sketchy, made leading scientists doubt the age of the Earth and evolution, and supernatural creation is just as viable as evolution. This is in a public school science textbook being funded by public money. Absolutely amazing.
Well, but it doesn't stop at creationism and religious dogma replacing evolution with the Book of Genesis. I mean, it also takes on global warming denial, do they not?
This book, I didn't see the sections on climate change as much in this book, mm-hmm. although there was a little bit of a hint. It celebrated at least George W. Bush's rejection of the Kyoto Protocol, because that was as much as we could tell from that. But often what we're seeing these days is that climate change denial is linked with denial of evolution, and my home state of Louisiana has a law which allows teachers to bring in supplemental materials to critique evolution and also climate change. And the whole point of this is to actually sneak in creationism and climate denial into the classroom. The evidence backing climate change and evolution is undeniable, and the only reason that they would be critiqued is to sneak non-science into a science classroom.
Well, but in terms of history, teaching people, students, that the New Deal did not help the economy, but instead it ushered in a new era of dependency on the federal government. I mean, that sounds like, you know, something that you'd hear at a young Republican gathering, you know?
Yeah. You often find with these schools that it's not just bad science, but it's sort of blatant political propaganda in the history lesson. So one lesson that we've mentioned a couple lessons now, but another lesson was that Jimmy Carter pardoned draft dodgers out of a, quote, misguided sense of compassion. What real history book would talk about whether the president's compassion and actions were misguided? Like that? There's a way to present it without blatant bias. You can talk about whether it was a mistake or not, but the misguided sense of compassion is such a dog whistle political propaganda.
Well, also describing the feminist movement as creating an entirely new class of females who lacked male financial support and who had to turn to the state as a surrogate husband. That sounds a bit like Governor Huckabee's mention of the women's libidos getting in the way.
Yeah, I've actually heard that several times today already, that exact same reference to Huckabee and the Responsible Education Movement. And I don't, honestly, I don't think public schools should be teaching history out of the mouths of a far-right presidential candidate.
So how did this happen then? How, I mean, let's go through some of the states that are involved here. Of course, we've talked about Texas, but they've made vast inroads into Tennessee, and you've been fighting them in Louisiana. So give us a kind of an accounting, if you will. I mean, I guess the main point to make is they're on a roll, right?
Mm-hmm. And so there's a couple of ways we see creationism brought into public school science classrooms. And one way is through legislation. And so in Louisiana and Tennessee, there's laws that allow, as I mentioned earlier, creationism to be snuck into science classes through supplemental materials to, quote, critique evolution. Now, evolution does not need to be critiqued. It's the strongest, especially in a high school science classroom, it's the strongest scientific, it's one of the strongest scientific theories out there. It's backed by all the evidence. The only critiques that would be done are religious creationist critiques, and that's not science, and that doesn't belong to science classroom. So we have these laws that potentially allow creationism into any school in the state, just depending on what a teacher wants to do. And we are finally seeing evidence of exactly what is happening. And just last week, the ACLU of Louisiana sued Sabine Parish in Louisiana. It's an amazing story where a teacher, the sixth grade biology teacher, was demanding that she described evolution as a stupid theory believed by stupid people. She was putting on her tests that students had to write that Jesus or that the Lord God created the earth on her tests and on all her science tests, which doesn't belong on a science test in a public school. She explained the earth was 6,000 years old, and eventually one of her students was Buddhist and didn't know how to answer the question about the Christian God creating the earth, and the teacher then humiliated him in front of the class. Called him stupid, called Buddhism stupid, and basically abused this kid for a sustained period of time. When the parents went to the superintendent of the school to complain about this, the superintendent told them that this is just the Bible Belt, they should get used to it, and suggested that the student change his religion, or if they didn't like that, they could transfer to another school in the district where there are, quote, more Asians over there. It was just unbelievable. And the reason we see this kind of behavior so blatantly is because there's laws on the books in Louisiana that would allow, that encourage teachers are directly viewed as a way to attack evolution. So a teacher now has the courage to go out there and say the earth is 6,000 years old, say that Buddhists are stupid, and punish students, take points off their tests for not writing creationism on their tests. And we see that in Louisiana with the Louisiana law, and we see it in response to that in Texas, this charter network of teaching creationism, where Texas has these curriculum standards that do the same thing as Louisiana's law, where they allow both sides to be taught to critique evolution. And this charter network in Texas is defending its curriculum, saying, we're doing what the state of Texas requires. We're just critiquing evolution and teaching both sides. And there's legislation, we see it introduced all across the country. Laws are only passed in Louisiana and Tennessee now to allow creationism to be taught, but every year we see bills introduced. We've already seen two bills introduced this year in Missouri, one in Oklahoma, and there's dozens every year that get introduced across the country that would allow teaching creationism in public schools. And another way creationism can get stuck in public schools is through the school voucher program. And this is when public money is spent on private schools, often that teach religion. And we're giving millions, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars to these private religious schools that teach things as ridiculous as the Loch Ness Monster is real and disproves evolution. And so while they may be private schools, they're funded with a lot of public money.
And again, I'm speaking with Zach Copland, who's an anti-creationist activist and columnist for The Guardian, who is a high school student, organized 78 Nobel laureate scientists in a campaign against the Louisiana Science Education Act, a creationism law. He has a new article in Slate magazine, Texas Public Schools Are Teaching Creationism. So let's talk about when you were at high school, you organized 78 Nobel laureates. That's no small accomplishment. Did it have an effect?
So it's had... We've built an incredible campaign to repeal Louisiana's creationism law. We've got everyone on board, from Nobel laureates to clergy to teachers from across the state and across the country and even around the world. And we've really got everyone in our camp except for Louisiana legislators. And so we've tried three times now, and we've come into Louisiana Senate Education Committee with a bill to repeal the creationism law. And this year we lost by the closest margin yet we've had, which was a 2-3 loss in this committee. And these legislators, one of them, our first time, explained, sort of summed up the problem is she didn't want to listen to people who had little letters behind their name, as she called them. And these Nobel laureates are just people with little letters behind their name. They don't seem to recognize that the 78 Nobel laureates we've arranged, which is about 40% of living Nobel laureate scientists, who really built the foundation we live on today, they don't seem to understand that the people you should listen to on science policy are the scientists who are the best scientists in the world. And we've got all the best scientists in the world. We've got the American Association for the Advancement of Science, these Nobel laureates, like all the biology organizations, all the National Science Teachers Organization are all telling Louisiana to repeal this law. And so we're hoping this year, between the support we've built and between this court case in Sabine Parish, Louisiana, about a teacher teaching creationism and really harassing a student over his Buddhist religion, that we may finally have the combination of things we need to force politicians in Louisiana to do the right thing.
Well, already they're teaching creationism in different degrees in Arkansas, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, mm-hmm. Louisiana, Ohio, yeah. Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Washington, D.C., and Wisconsin. So that's a good chunk of America.
Yeah.
And this is, it's easy to sort of joke about it and shrug it off as being the rubes, with their pitchforks, et cetera. But the point about it is that in these states, there are kids that deserve a real education, and they're not getting it. And they may be equipped to live in a kind of a little Christian backwater, but they're not going to be equipped to live in the real world.
And also, I would point out, it's not just – I mean, these are the states where we know we've sort of identified public money being given to either public – like to schools, private schools that teach creationism, or public schools that have the ability or have been documented teaching creationism. But it's not just a problem in these states, because around the country, 13% of public school science teachers admit to teaching creationism outright in their science classes, and another 60% on top of that either balance both sides or don't teach evolution fully, either because they're afraid of backlash from parents or they don't actually understand or believe the science themselves, which means that about 73% of American students aren't getting the education and evolution that they deserve. And that hits the heart of this problem. It's not a Louisiana problem. It's not a Texas problem. It's an American problem. And we can see it all over the country.
Well, we'll end up as America the Stupid at this rate. And I thank you for joining us, Zach Coplin.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Zach Coplin, who's an anti-creationism activist and columnist for The Guardian, who, as a high school student, organized 78 Nobel laureate scientists in a campaign against the Louisiana Science Education Act, a creationism law. He has a new report in Slate, Texas Public Schools Are Teaching Creationism. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with George Lakoff about his ideas of what the president should say in his upcoming State of the Union.
Burning ice. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe in the second chance? Do you believe in rapture, babe?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, where he has taught since 1972. He's the author of Don't Think of an Elephant and The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide of Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Veeling. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The State of the Union 2014, The Cognitive Power of the President. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
And, George, there's rumors that the president's going to come out swinging on Tuesday night, that he's going to threaten to bypass Congress and show a more assertive style or side of him, perhaps. A lot of people, of course, think it's somewhat overdue. He has been treated, I think, with the most hideous and often racist disrespect that I don't think most modern presidents have had to put up with. How would it play if he came out and basically told those people that there's a new sheriff in town?
It played very, very well. People want to see a powerful president.
Do you think they will on Tuesday night?
I don't know if they will. I hope so. I think it would be the smartest thing for him to do. It is always better to go on offense than defense, especially if you're president.
So what has inhibited him in the past? One of the theories I have heard is that he doesn't want to come across as an angry black man, because that will just feed the Fox News and the Rush Limbaugh machine.
Well, people have been saying that for the last 5 years, and that may be in part true. I think rather he has, from the beginning, seen himself as the president of all the people. And he doesn't want to come across as the president of some of the people. But, you know, at this point, in order to be president of all the people, he's got to come out swinging.
So in terms of your article at the Huffington Post, George Lakoff, State of the Union 2014, The Cognitive Power of the President, your caveat is, of course, you're saying that this is what you'd like him to say, but what you don't expect him to say. But since Jay Carney and the White House have already leaked the suggestion that the president might bypass Congress and try and deliver directly to the American people, and the president himself says, we're not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing for Americans the kind of help they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone. So if he's going to go the executive route by issuing executive orders, you've listed some pretty good ones here. Let's start with the first one that you've suggested here, is he could issue an executive order for the government to grant contracts only to companies that pay their workers above the minimum wage, with a higher minimum wage. A good place to start.
Excellent place to start. And what it would mean, essentially, is raising the minimum wage, because a lot of companies compete for contracts even if they lose. So they would have to raise the minimum wage even if they didn't get the contracts. And, you know, that would spread. So basically, he can effectively, for much of the country, raise the minimum wage with a stroke of the pen. And, you know, by the way, this isn't an original idea. This idea has been floating around for some time, both for cases of the minimum wage and for many other things. After all, he is commander-in-chief of the military. He could, you know, say all sorts of things that people in the military would have to do as commander-in-chief. So there are, and the military extends all over the country, to military bases, to veterans' hospitals, and so on. He has all sorts of powers over, you know, vast reaches of the country.
So explain, if you will, your thesis, though, underlying your article at the Huffington Post, George Lakoff, that beyond material power, the president has even greater power, cognitive power.
Well, the president can introduce ideas into public discourse. And I've written for many years about how conservative presidents did that. You know, George Bush, from the first day in office, started talking about tax relief, assuming that taxes were an affliction, that if you wanted to keep or raise taxes, you were just hurting people more and so on. And this was part of an overall conservative view, not just of taxation, but of the entire economic program of conservatism. That is, you know, and this idea, you know, kept being put out there and putting out there until even Democrats started talking about middle-class tax relief and so on. Tax relief is an idea. It's not just language. It's an idea, and it's an idea that depends on other ideas, namely relief is relief of an affliction. And if you're relieving it, you're a hero. And if you're not, you're a villain. And then taxation is an affliction. And that only makes sense if you're not thinking of the government as using taxes to provide, you know, resources, public resources for everybody that everybody needs, especially businesses. So this is, you know, a very important idea that Bush got out there right away. And this is something that Obama could get out there that has to do with, you know, the Democrats not saying things. The Republicans have calculated on getting their ideas out there for many, many years, starting with Reagan saying government is the problem and many other things of that sort. And now there is a chance to actually tell truths. But to tell truths, you have to use language that isn't out there now. And it won't be familiar necessarily. What that means is you've got to use language that people will get immediately, but that will have to be repeated over and over so that the idea expressed by the language will be parts of people's brains. And that's how things change in a country. That is, when you hear ideas that express, language that expresses an idea, and you hear it over and over, your brain changes. You get that idea, whether you agree with it or not, it becomes part of your brain. You may disagree with it, but you're still thinking it, and it becomes part of public discourse, and the language for it becomes part of public discourse. And once it's part of public discourse, and once the idea is out there, you can think about and talk about the consequences of that idea and how to make that idea real. So that actually is an enormous power that the president has. And there are hundreds of things that he could change that way.
Again, I'm speaking with George Lakoff, who's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, where he has taught since 1972. He's the author of Don't Think of an Elephant and The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Verling. He has an article at the Huffington Post, State of the Union 2014, The Cognitive Power of the President. So, I mean, clearly, you know, for all of the propaganda that the Republicans have successfully launched in the last few decades, starting with Ronald Reagan, against government, where government is the problem, as you pointed out, you know, one wonders why the Democrats didn't turn around and say, you know, we're not, it's not a question of big government, it's a question of better government. So what is their deficit? I know you've argued about it and pointed out the deficits in framing and semantics on the Democratic side in this.
Before I go into that, and I do want to go into it, let me give you examples of the kind of ideas that need to get out there. You know, let's start with, a very, very simple one. Pensions. What are pensions? Pensions are delayed payments for work already done. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what pensions are.
Right. They're not something that's not in the freeloader category,
They're not gifts. They're not payments for not working. They are delayed payments for work already done. And these were, you know, offered by companies as benefits for the company, actually. Because if you take part of someone's salary and you say, okay, I'll invest that money for you and pay you the rest of this salary 30 years from now, then I can invest it, take the increase in value from the investments and pay you 30 years from now. Now, that's a way that the companies can do well if they invest the money well, and that the workers can do well, and have retirement income. That's an extremely important part of our legacy. So what has happened, however, is that both companies and municipalities and states have taken that money and spent it on something else. and they've acted as if they were gifts. And they use the word benefits. Benefits suggest that these are gifts. And then they say, well, we can't afford these benefits anymore, you know. Well, what do you mean you can't afford it? They were earned. They're part of salaries. You have a contract, you know, to pay those salaries. You know, you're supposed to check up on them. And there should be transparency about all pension funds. You know, they should be checked up on every year to make sure they're still there, that they haven't been put someplace else. This is a very big deal.
So obligation and instead of benefit then. Is that the, would obligation be the right word?
It's not just obligation. It's earnings.
Mm-hmm.
It's delayed earnings.
Okay.
You know, earnings to be paid later. I mean, it's very, very straightforward. These are earned.
Right.
They're salaries. You know, and you say it out loud, and you have to repeat it over and over. And places that you know, governors who want to cut, you know, pensions, or mayors who want to cut pensions, are simply stealing. And you have to say, they're stealing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
There are things like that all over the place. For example, workers are profit creators. You know, they say, you know, okay, owners of factories are job creators, but workers create profits. And then there's a certain thing called productivity, which is the amount of profit per worker. Well, when productivity goes up, that's because the productivity of the workers has gone up. They've earned it. But their salaries have been pretty much flat relative to inflation for 30 years, right? Productivity has gone way up, and the workers who have created those profits haven't gotten a share of them. They deserve them. That is what all of the arguments about fair wages is about. I mean, that's crucial everywhere. And it's not just about minimum wages. It's about fair wages. It's about living wages. Right? And to make that case, you have to have the idea that workers are profit creators. Without that idea, the whole argument goes. It has to be repeated over and over again.
And in terms of your suggestion, George Lakoff, that the president take on the issue of our climate crisis, he hasn't exactly been robust in taking on nuclear and coal and natural gas. In fact, much of the policies that have come forth lately have been to celebrate natural gas. And my understanding is from the fracking mania that's going on now, a lot of natural gas, the methane seeps out, and it's about 100 times worse as an aggressive greenhouse gas. So whatever gains you get from burning natural gas are offset by the leakage. And yet that's not even factoring in that in every home in the country that has gas, there's usually leakage somewhere in the grid, and that's all methane again. So this really isn't a national inventory on how much the natural gas business is causing us more problems than solving global warming. So you're suggesting in your article at the Huffington Post that he should talk about immoral fuels.
Absolutely. Look, natural gas is a fossil fuel just like coal and oil. And it does have a huge leakage problem, which may make it just as bad as coal and oil. And that's something that needs to be said out loud. Now, on the case of coal, it's, you know, coal is going down anyway. But people are trying to still blow up mountaintops and ship coal to the third world, thus, you know, burning coal somewhere else and putting it into our atmosphere just as badly as if it were burned here. So, I mean, that's not exactly wonderful. He should take it on, and he should let people know that people generally don't know just how bad these things are and how bad the climate crisis is. You know, we know in California we've got a drought. We know that, there are hurricanes, that are caused by global warming, systemically caused by global warming, in the East Coast and other floods in the Midwest and so on. We have huge climate crises, which are extremely costly. But, you know, not just in dollars, $60 billion for Hurricane Sandy, but costly in terms of life and property and enjoyment of life and so on. And they're going to go on and get worse. This has got to stop. And not only that, they cause terrible things internationally. They extend deserts. One of the reasons for the war in Syria has been drought in northern Syria that caused huge migration in Syria and that led to all sorts of conflicts in Syria that sparked a lot of what was going on in Syria. I mean, this is not something to be taken lightly. A study by the Defense Department said that the most serious worry that the Defense Department has about the future is future wars developing out of global warming disasters. This is something that needs to be said and said out loud. And something more, people think of it in terms of the word environment, as if the environment was out there somewhere, like, you know, over in Alaska where there are polar bears, you know. Nature is inside of us. You know, we breathe air, we breathe the pollution, we drink water, we drink the pollution, eat food, we eat the pesticides. I mean, they come inside of us, in our bodies. You know, if you're in a drought or a flood, you are physically affected, and it's going to affect your children, your grandchildren, and so on, all the worse. So, I mean, these are things that have to be said out loud and repeated over and over. And the idea that that what is called the environment, that nature is at stake, we're destroying nature. And in that destruction of nature, you know, we're destroying species of fish, with bees that are absolutely necessary for pollinating all of our fruits and vegetables. We are destroying bees, you know, but not just bees. If you look at the tar sands oil, in Canada, where is it being dug up? It's being dug up by the destruction of one of the world's largest arboreal forests, which is the home of a huge percentage of the songbirds in the whole world, of the migrating songbirds. They're killing off large percentages of the world's songbirds. You know, songbirds are part of our world, and they're part of who we are.
Well, George Lakoff, just in the last minute then, I would think that when you just mentioned what we put into our bodies and the pollution in the environment, that there was nothing more striking than what happened recently in West Virginia, where people couldn't drink water because of the chemical spill, and it really makes you realize how basic clean drinking water is. That's in the zeitgeist. Don't you think the president should jump on that?
It's in my paper, exactly. The president should jump on that. He should jump on the Arkansas case, you know, where there was a pipeline spill that basically destroyed a town, and that luckily the town was just on the other side of the Mississippi. It could have destroyed, you know, huge amounts of, you know, or polluted huge amounts of this country had it occurred a couple of miles away. These are some things to be brought up and discuss very seriously. The president should, with a stroke of the pen, say, sorry, no XL pipeline. And the arguments for it are easy. They say, oh, we need the pipeline because it is safe, which it isn't. You know, the initial use of pipelines in the in near Canada, the first 11 months they used the pipeline, they had basically a leak every month. I mean, this is very serious stuff there. The pipelines are not safe. They're under enormous pressure and heat, and they carry 800,000 gallons a day of the dirtiest oil on Earth. I mean, this is you know, laced with poisons in order to make it flow at all. I mean, this is serious. Most people don't know anything about this, and the president needs to, you know, say no, no XL pipeline. Now, the argument that, instead, people just use railroads. Well, we've had railroad explosions and leaks recently, and they should be outlawed because the oil is being transported on the railroads in unsafe old tank cars, you know, and the oil companies can't afford to buy new ones. So they couldn't transport the oil if they did it safely. We should bring down regulations on the safety of oil transportation immediately, right? And then the other argument is, well, the Canadians will just build a pipeline to the Pacific and send it to Asia. Well, they'll send it to Asia anyway, but the point is they're not going to build that pipeline. Why? Because it goes through Native American territory, and it goes over the Rockies. It's both expensive and horrendous to even try to build, and it's not going to be allowed. So in short, you know, the XL pipeline is a major big deal. And the president could come out fighting right away and say, no, right here, I'm president. This is the end. We have to stop global warming.
Well, George Lakoff, I thank you very much for joining us. Obviously, we have our fingers crossed here that the president will come out fighting and will lay down some markers here. And I'll be anxious to see whether he picks up on your ideas.
Well, I don't expect him to, as I said. I think he'll do some of it here and there. I think he'll do more than he did before. But I think he's been pretty cautious. And I think he's going to take cautious first steps in executive orders. But, you know, he could, you know, write 100 executive orders, you know, in a week, so many that the conservatives couldn't even follow them.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, George Lakoff.
Okay. A pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff. He's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1972. He's the author of Don't Think of an Elephant and The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Veeling. He has an article at the Huffington Post, State of the Union 2014, The Cognitive Power of the President. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rushert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.